Those Who Fear God, the second talk in a series entitled Those Who Belong to God, was presented by Ron Julian on August 18, 1996, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We're going to continue talking today, actually some of the material that I've been working on in this book that I'm writing. The topic is the different ways in which the Bible refers to those who are saved. We're very used to thinking of Christians, of the people of God, as those who believe in Jesus. There are many passages that we could think of that would call us to have faith, to believe the story of the gospel, and so on. But what's striking, if you think about it from those in those terms, is that the Bible has a lot of other ways of describing those who belong to God that are not just optional sort of nice ideal qualities to be pursuing after you believe in Jesus, but in fact are actually given as qualities that must characterize those who come to God. In other words, believing in Jesus is tied to a number of other qualities and ideas in the life of a believer. Last week we talked about the person of God as the one who loves God. And there are a number of places where the Bible makes it clear that it is those who love God who are His people, who are under His care and will receive His blessing in the end. Before we go on to the next one that I wanted to talk about today, I wanted to make a comment about that, about what I said last time about loving God, because I got a question afterwards that I thought was a good question and one that I think would be helpful for me to clarify. For those of you who weren't here, basically I was saying that the concept of loving God in the Bible is not so much the emotional state of feeling warm tenderness, warm emotions towards God, but it is to see in God that which is my treasure, that which I don't want to lose. God, His character, His promises. I love Him in the sense that I do not love the world. I look at the world and say, no, somehow this is not ultimately going to give me what I want. But God and His promises, that's where real life is to be found. And so if I'm going to cling to one in opposition to the other, I'm going to cling to God. And that was what I was arguing with. I could give some more explanation, but essentially that's what I was saying last week about loving God. Well, the question came up afterwards about what I had said about the emotions involved in loving God. And this person was saying that in their experience, there are times when there is a great emotional component in their relationship with God. And this person was wondering whether I was denying that that was in fact the case. And I wanted to just clarify, I thought it was worth clarifying, that that's not at all what I was saying. Speaking for myself, my journey of faith has been an emotional roller coaster at times, but there's certainly an incredibly strong emotional component to it. Our emotions play a great part in our faith because we are people who have emotions and we have to deal with those emotions, and I wasn't in any way meaning to contradict that. What I was saying, though, is that we might get the idea that loving God is to be equated with a certain emotional state. I go to a worship service, the music is really good, the praying is really getting going, and I get into this emotional state where I feel, I may feel like crying, I may feel, you know, very emotional and warm towards God. All I really was trying to say is that the biblical concept of loving God is not necessarily connected with that emotional state. That is, we can love God, and we do love God, at times when our emotions may be something very different. I can love God at times when I am feeling distressed. I may feel tempted to even be upset with God for the difficulties and the things that are coming into my life. And yet, in the midst of that, if I cling to Him, if I turn to Him, if I trust Him and continue to see Him as my refuge, then I am loving Him, even if I'm not particularly in that state where I feel like singing. And likewise, to be in that state where I feel like singing doesn't necessarily mean that I love God. Because I think experience shows us that people can get themselves into emotional states because it feels good without necessarily having that inner sort of commitment, that inner sort of sense that God is my refuge and He is the one, in fact, that I am committing my life to, that I am seeking my good in Him. So that's what I was trying to say, is that on the one hand, the emotions play a tremendous role in our life, and I don't at all want to deny it. And I don't look down on those times when we feel like singing or the singing makes us feel warm towards God. There's nothing wrong with that, and there can be something very right about it. I'm just saying that when the Bible calls us to love God and speaks of us as those who love God, it's not primarily talking about the emotional state that happens at a worship service. It's talking about, do I love God or do I love the world? Do I love God or do I love whatever pleasures and triumphs I may be able to find in this life? The question is, what do I see or who do I see as my treasure, that which is valuable and desirable to me? If I can only keep one thing, what's it going to be? The person who loves God is the one who in the end will hold to God over anything else. That's what I would understand. So I wanted to clarify that because I thought that was a good question. I think sometimes that I can give the impression, because I do warn against thinking that emotional states in and of themselves define our faith, that somehow I'm sort of begrudgingly allowing that, okay, it may be appropriate every now and again to have an emotion. And that's not at all what I'm saying. I think particularly maybe because for myself, I'm a student of the Bible, and I mean, that's what I do. I'm studying the Bible and I'm trying to understand what it has to say about life. Perhaps I give the impression that I think that the height of spirituality is somehow this emotionless state sitting at your desk doing a word study or something like that. And that's not at all what I think. That's not at all how I live. But the quality of loving God is not talking so much about my emotions. My emotions are going to trail along with my commitments, but the idea of loving God in the Bible is talking more about my beliefs, my commitments. What is the bottom line for me? What is life really all about in the end? What Jack refers to sometimes from his philosophical background as my subjectivity. What is it that I see as defining my life? And to love God means ultimately that I see God as the one who is defining my life. That Him, His values, His mercy, His love, His promises, all of that, I look at that and say, yeah, that's where it is. That's where I want to go. That's where I want to be. That's who I want to follow. Okay. The quality that I want to talk about today that the Bible refers to is that the salvation comes to those who fear God. I talked about loving God last time. Today I want to talk about fearing God. There's a very famous verse in the Old Testament, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." But fearing God is not just an Old Testament idea. We might, if we were to read the Bible casually or think about it casually, get the idea that somehow God was to be feared in the Old Testament, but now because of the cross of Christ we have acceptance and now we don't fear God because we have a different deal. But I don't think that holds up. That's not the picture that we find when we look in the New Testament. For instance, in Acts we read about the centurion named Cornelius, a devout man and one who feared God with all his household and gave many alms to the Jewish people and prayed to God continually. And then later Peter is told, Cornelius, a centurion, an upright and God-fearing man who is well spoken of by the whole Jewish nation, was directed by a holy angel to send for you to come to his house and to hear what you have to say. And opening his mouth, Peter said, "I most certainly understand now that God is not one to show partiality, but in every nation, the man who fears him and does what is right is welcome to him." And what's striking is that Peter sees Cornelius as being one who is welcome to God, one that God has accepted and embraced. He's a man who prays to God, and he is told that his prayers have been heard. But he describes him as a man who fears God and does what is right. And he's saying that anyone who fears God and does what is right is welcome to him. Well, it would be equally interesting to talk about that phrase, "and does what is right." Perhaps we will somewhere along the line here. But today I want to concentrate on the first part of that. The man who fears God is welcome to him. Well, what does that mean? The idea of fearing God may seem a little problematic, especially in the light of what we know of the cross and the acceptance that we find in the cross. Doesn't God love us? Isn't that what we're told? Isn't he on my side? Doesn't John say that perfect love casts out fear? I mean, in what sense am I being asked to fear God? Because I think I am. Even in the face of verses like perfect love casts out fear, I think that the New Testament is describing us as the people of God, as those who fear God. Some people have proposed that fear is perhaps an unfortunate translation, and maybe we should translate it more something like being in awe of God. So that fearing God is looking at him and seeing how big and powerful and loving he is and being sort of blown away by the awesomeness of God. And there's an element of that, I think, in it, but that doesn't really capture what the Bible is talking about, because there really is an element of fear that the word fear captures very well, I think. It's helpful for us to contrast, using a contrast that the Bible itself makes. The Bible speaks about fearing God in contrast to fearing men. And there, clearly, when it talks about fearing men, it doesn't mean being in awe of men, looking at men and saying, "Wow, aren't they amazing?" There's really an element of, who do I fear? Who is it let me put it this way. I think the idea of fearing God or fearing anyone in the biblical terms is seeing God or whoever as the power to be dealt with, the one whose goodwill I mustn't lose. So if I fear men, then the bottom line for me is I had better not let other people be unhappy with me, because then I'm really going to lose. I've got to keep them happy whatever I do. And conversely, if I fear God, then my attitude is, I've got to keep God happy with me whatever I do. If I have to choose between am I going to let you be unhappy with me or God be unhappy with me? I'm going to let you be unhappy with me. Because in the end, I recognize who it is that I'm dealing with when I'm dealing with God. Good verse to illustrate this idea is a statement of Jesus from Luke 12. And I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that have no more that they can do. But I will warn you whom to fear. Fear the one who, after he has killed, has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. So, I mean, it's a very striking thing that Jesus is saying, but he's basically saying, why would you fear men? That is, in the sense of giving in to them to try to keep them happy. Because at most, all I can do to you is kill you, which is, I mean, that sounds like enough. I mean, it sounds like enough to me. But that's what's striking about what Jesus is saying is, all they can do is kill you. You have more serious things to think about than death. You have bigger problems to deal with than just dying. The kind of fear that he's talking about here is not having a terror of God, not feeling somehow that God is against me and that I have to cower and hide from him. But the fact is that there are dangers out there in the world. If people are unhappy with me, there are certain prices that I may have to pay. And likewise, if God is unhappy with me, there's a certain price that I'm going to have to pay. The question is, ultimately, who do I see as the most dangerous? If I have to make someone unhappy, which one would I choose? That's what Jesus is essentially asking us to consider. And in that context, it's a part of a talk that he gives to his disciples when he sends them out, telling them that when they go out in his name, that they are going to find rejection. There are going to be people who will not like what they have to say. But he's encouraging them to not fear men. In the end, whose goodwill do you want to have? Who would it be most important to keep happy, to do what that person wants you to do? We see that illustrated when the Sanhedrin tells Peter and the other disciples to stop preaching about Jesus. And Peter basically says, well, you know, look, you tell me. Which does it make more sense? Should I obey you or should I obey God? It's that idea that even if you arrest us or kill us, the fact is that God has called us to do something and we fear him, not you. We can see sort of the illustration of the opposite in the parable of the unjust judge. Jesus describes him, there was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God and did not respect man. And the widow keeps coming to him asking for justice. And for a while he was unwilling, but afterward he said to himself, even though I do not fear God nor respect man, yet because this widow bothers me, I will give her legal protection. So the whole idea is, what pressures does this judge respond to? What is it that's going to move his hand, that's going to inspire him to act? He doesn't fear God and he doesn't respect man. So he doesn't care that the God of justice would look at the way that he deals with this widow and the other people that he passes judgment for. He doesn't care that God would look at that and say, this is unjust. This is not right. Because he doesn't fear God. God's opinion exerts no pressure on him because in the end he really doesn't care what God thinks about it. But there comes a point where he does fear whatever it is this widow can do to him in making his life miserable. So in the end, he acts because he fears the inconvenience that this widow may be to him. So again, the idea is not who do you go in terror of, but what pressures mean something to you? Whose opinion is valuable to you? We can see this again in what I think is a very interesting little passage in Philippians. Philippians chapter 2, very famous section where Paul inspires, calls them to self-sacrifice in dealing with each other, and he gives the example of Jesus himself and the incarnation, a very important passage. But at the end of that, in verses 12 and 13, he says, "So then, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure." Now, I think we sometimes misunderstand this verse. I think I have misunderstood it in the past. It is so striking, this language, work out your salvation, for it is God who is at work in you, that we get the idea that Paul's purpose here was to show this sort of paradox. You work out your salvation because God is working in you. This idea that somehow you're working because God's working was the point that Paul wanted to make, the thrust of his argument. But I think that's not right. I mean, that's true enough. The idea is true enough. But that's not what he's trying to say here, I don't think. Notice what he says, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. And I would put the emphasis there. The real emphasis in this passage, I think, is on the fear and trembling that is due to the fact that God is at work, even when Paul is absent. Because notice how he talks about, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence. Paul recognizes that there are times when his presence might make them sort of toe the line and behave themselves, because this is an apostle and we don't want him to think poorly of us. In other words, they might fear him in the sense that while he's around, we want to make sure that we're on our best behavior. But what about when he's gone? What about when his presence is not there to sort of check their irritation with each other and encourage them to keep on their best behavior? Well, they ought to be working out their salvation just as hard, all the more, when Paul is gone as they would when he is there. Because it is God who is at work among them. It is God that they have to deal with, not Paul. So essentially, I think what he's saying here is, you're idiot if you fear me. What have you got to fear from me? There's nothing I can do. Fear the God who is just as much at work when I'm gone as when I'm there. Work out your salvation in fear and trembling, because you recognize that it is your Creator and Judge that you're dealing with, not me. So I'm not there and I can't see what's happening. What does that matter? You have a salvation to work out. You are either going to embrace that salvation or turn away from it. And it is the Creator of the universe that you're ultimately going to have to respond to. So again, what Paul is saying to them is, the question is, whom do you fear? Where ultimately are the pressures that you're going to respond to? If you're only concerned about pursuing Christian stuff when I'm around to be watching you, then what does that mean in the end? But if you know that it's God that you have to deal with, and that this salvation that you're pursuing is very real and is going to determine the eternal outcome of your life, then you pursue that salvation with fear. Not fear because God is terrible and he's going to hurt me, but fear in the very real and sober sense that I recognize that my eternal destiny is at stake now. And it's not dependent on Paul. It's dependent on the God who created me, the God who is at work now. So fear God and pursue your salvation. There are a number of places where we see these kinds of ideas. In Colossians, Paul says, "Slaves, in all things, obey those who are your masters on earth, not with external service, as those who merely please men, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord." And again, the issue is, whom do you fear? As a slave, as a servant, you have this job, you have a master that you are responsible to please. you could obey this master out of a sense of, I have to keep him happy, because he can adversely affect my life if I don't keep him happy. So I'm going to just do what it takes to keep this guy happy, and as long as I do that, then I'm okay. Well, Paul refers to that as external service. That is, I may inside be self-centered, uninterested in my master's interests, uninterested in conducting myself with integrity, with compassion, but as long as I can externally keep him happy, things will be okay. But what Paul is saying is, while you are in the midst of conducting your life, while you are in the midst of serving this master for whom you are a servant, you're really the servant of another. If you fear God, then it's not my master's response so much that is of concern to me, but it is my Creator's response. It is my true master, my Lord, that I am striving for goodness in the way that I conduct myself. I'm going to give to my master, the one that I'm working for, not just because I fear what he can do to me, but that I recognize that it is right, that it is appropriate for me to be generous, to be self-sacrificing, to be responsible in the way I conduct myself toward my master, because the one whom I really fear has called me to live that way. I mean, I recognize, I see it in myself, I think we all recognize that it is very easy. I mean, we're talking basically about jobs here right now. I mean, it's not that different, the slave in the ancient times and the worker today really don't have so many things that are different between them. It's very easy in that kind of situation to be focused on the immediate situation. How can I keep these people happy? How can I keep my job? How can I avoid unpleasantness? How can I function successfully in this environment? But the person who fears God is learning that there is more to life than just the immediate circumstances, that I'm actually dealing with someone much bigger than my boss or whoever it is else that I'm dealing with. And in learning that and coming to believe that, then my actions are lining up with something bigger and something more important than just the immediate success or failure in the work environment. So I may do something that is going to be costly to me on the short run, but I may do it because I believe that the God that I am following and serving has called me to live that way. So the pressures are out there. There's the pressure from my work, from my environment in this world, but there is the pressure of the call of God, His character, His commands, His promises. What does that all mean to me? Ultimately, we are being called to be people who respond to that pressure, who see it as being more important. Well, there's a number of other passages we could look at that all, I think, basically suggest the same kind of thing. Let me say that, hopefully it's clear by this time, that the idea of fearing God is not the same thing as being afraid of God, of being terrorized by God. And we have passages that show us that that's not the right way to think about it. In Romans 8, a very important passage, Romans 8:15, "For you have not received a spirit of slavery leading to fear again, but you have received a spirit of adoption as sons, by which we cry out, Abba, Father." In this passage, Paul has been talking about, throughout Romans, he's been talking about the contrast between coming to God in faith, believing in the promise of forgiveness and redemption that's found in the cross of Christ, versus the approach of his Jewish opponents, who believed that they were the law, that they were keeping the law, and that God accepted them because they were keeping the law. Paul sees the law essentially as making us slaves, in the sense that the slave is, he is responsible to keep his master happy. And if his master is not happy, then the master's wrath will rightly come down upon him. Under the law, we're like slaves. We're rejected by God ultimately because we're not good enough. We don't measure up by the standard of the law. But in the gospel, we have received not a spirit of slavery leading to fear, and that fear would be, I'm not measuring up. I can't do this. God is not going to be pleased with me because I'm not good enough for God to be pleased with me. No, we have received a spirit of adoption as sons. We're a part of the family. As believers, we have been embraced by God. We belong to Him like we were part of His blood. And so we can expect to inherit. And that's the point of this verse, if we kind of look at the whole context in Romans. The whole point is, what am I going to get in the end? The slave really deserves nothing at the hand of the master, but he's constantly in that sense of, if I don't measure up, I'm going to get it. I'm going to suffer. The son, the one who is a part of the family, is embraced and accepted, and in the end inherits everything that belongs to the father. So, rather than having the spirit of slavery leading to fear, where I must fear that somehow I'm going to earn the wrath of God because I'm not good enough to measure up, I have been accepted and can expect to inherit. There's this great inheritance there, and I, as a child of God, have that inheritance as my birthright. That's the picture, I think, that we have in Romans. Well, you can see that there's a very real sense then in which we are being called not to fear God. I'm not looking at myself and saying, oh, I'm afraid that I am going to receive the wrath of God for what I am, as much as I deserve it, because the cross of Christ has freed me from that fear. That fear should not be mine, because I recognize that the costly blood of Jesus has paid the price for my sin and made it possible for me to belong to God and thus inherit ultimately. I'm not supposed to be afraid of God in the sense that I look at my own sins and fear that I will not be accepted. That fear has been lifted off of my shoulders through what Jesus has done on the cross. Maybe the most interesting juxtaposition of these two ideas is found in Acts, where in Acts 9:31 it says, "So the church throughout all Judea and Galilee and Samaria enjoyed peace, being built up and going on in the fear of the Lord and in the comfort of the Holy Spirit, it continued to increase." Well, what's striking is that at one and the same time, these people are described as those who have a fear of the Lord, and yet they are being comforted, encouraged by the Holy Spirit. The Spirit of God is strengthening them, encouraging them, giving them a place to stand where they feel accepted by God and thus can stand against the world, can be encouraged and strengthened so that they can go on in their faith. So the fear of the Lord, properly understood, is not a debilitating thing. It does not tear us down. Ultimately, it goes along with ideas like comfort and all of the fruits of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, all of that. All of those things go along with a proper sort of fear of God. Bottom line here, everybody fears something. And by that I don't mean we have a phobia about something. I mean everyone recognizes that there are realities out there that I have to deal with, things that I cannot ignore. If I ignore them, I'm going to suffer. So I have to deal with them. I have to understand what they're about and take some steps to meet them, because I recognize that they can affect me adversely if I don't. Fear of God means seeing past the fears of this life. The fear that I might lose my wealth, or that other people might disapprove of me, or that I might die. Ultimately, the fear of God is to see past those things, to see what the bottom line reality is. That God is there, that He's my Creator, that His approval means everything to me. For Him to say, welcome to me, means eternal life and blessing and righteousness and everything that human existence is meant to be. And if He turns away from me, then I am doomed. That's the bottom line. There's nothing else in this world that is as significant as God and how I stand with Him. There's not a single thing that can affect me in this life that can affect me as deeply or as permanently as my relationship with God can. Knowing this, then, the pressure that I ultimately respond to is the call of God to follow Him and find forgiveness and blessing with Him. And so to fear God means to recognize that the only real tragedy would be if I failed to follow Him and so lost everything. Okay, well, let me throw it open here now for some questions and comments. Margaret?
I was just, when you were talking about God being our Father, it just reminded me of Psalm 103, where it talks about, as far as the east is from the west, so far has He removed our transgressions from us. Maybe I can do this. But just as a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear Him. So at the same time, you're talking about, there's this correlation between, when He's talking about our iniquities, and it is a fact.
Right.
And here are these people who fear Him, and it doesn't, the correlation is not, it is between children and fearing. It's not between transgression and fearing.
Right.
So, He's not saying that there's this sequence of, we transgress, He kind of flinch like this, He looks down and says, oh, poor guys, you know, we'll take care of it. It's more like we transgress. He looks down, sees the transgression, simultaneously says, my children, how does a father respond to his children when they transgress? Before maybe even the children have figured out they've transgressed, before they even had a chance to have any kind of emotional response, it's, well, they're my children. That's the most significant jump in this equation here. It's not, have they transgressed, have they not transgressed? It's, they are my children, and I know they're my children, and they know they're my children because they think of me as their father. So that's the first thing that comes to mind. It's not, have you measured up or not? If you measured up, you can be my child. If you haven't measured up, you can't be my child. But you are my child, number one fact. Secondly, I look down, you're transgressing. Well, they're my children, so how do I respond to my transgressing children? I don't say, get out of my sight, I never want to see you again. We deal with it, we fix it, or something like that. So it's the fear and the children that go together, not the fear and the transgression that go together.
Right. And that's a good point, is that that's the thing that makes us nervous about the language of fearing God, is that sense that that my transgressions, if I come to understand the kind of person that I am, that I would connect fear with that and rightly think about what I rightly deserve and think that somehow then fearing God would be this barrier. It would recognize that there's a barrier between us that ought to be there, and I'm just waiting for the axe to fall or something like that. Kind of think about what always struck me as a very appropriate response. One of the most striking passages in the Bible to me, I've often looked at it and thought about it and felt this way, basically, is when Jesus tells, they've been out fishing all day, and Jesus tells Peter, well, put the net in over there, on the side of the boat. And he does, and they can't even bring it in because it's got so much fish in it. And Peter's response, I heard R.C. Sproul talking about this recently. I thought he made a good point. You would think his response would be, Jesus, I want to make sure I'm always hanging around with you because this is really great. I mean, I've been a fisherman all my life, and we've never gotten such a big... But his response is, he throws himself on the bottom of the boat and says, go away. You know, I mean, I'm an evil man. And that sense that somehow our recognition of ourselves in relationship to God, there is a kind of a fear that would suggest, I mean, the fear would be, I'm doomed because I don't belong to a God like this. This is not, he and I are not the same sort of stuff. But you're right, that's not the place where the connection is happening. It's not unrelated. I mean, in the midst of my fear of God, I recognize that I am a sinner that does not deserve the kindness of God. But what has to be a part of that picture is the character of God in forgiving and welcoming. But I'm recognizing that there is this welcome and forgiveness there, but I fear God in the sense that I recognize that to turn my back on such grace, to say, I think I'll go for this thing over here instead, would be foolish, because the grace of God is the only thing that's going to rescue me. The grace of God is the only thing that's going to give me life. And there's nothing in this world that can do it. So the person who fears God then is the one who recognizes that to turn away from grace to pursue wealth or to make sure that I don't die or something like that would be a foolish thing, because I don't fear that as much as I fear God, as much as I fear what would happen if I were to not be a part of his grace. Anything else? Does this make sense? Is this like, oh yeah, I've heard all this before, or no, I'm not buying it, or I mean, well, I guess we've come to, yes, please.
On the perfect love cast out fear, mm-hmm. I think that's just a little bit earlier, I would say, or just slightly before that.
I've had a brain glitch then. I thought that was in 1 John.
maybe it's also 1 John, because I don't know 1 John very well.
There's something similar to that in Romans 8, I think.
Okay, well, I must be thinking of... I'm probably thinking of the thing that you quoted.
Right.
Okay, but right. When he says perfect love casts out fear, at one point... I thought it was saying, if you love God perfectly, then you won't feel fear.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But now I'm thinking he probably means that if we recognize how much God loves us, we will be unable to be terrorized. Mm-hmm. That the consequence of recognizing God's love for us will be that.
I'm not sure. That makes sense. I mean, that would be my preference too, but 1 John is very difficult, I think. And he speaks in a very cryptic way through that stuff, and trying to follow his thinking through that section is particularly difficult, but that would be my inclination right now too. As we end up, since some of you have been a part of my travails over the years, I should probably tell you that during these 2.5 weeks that Robbie and the kids were gone, which, I'm not kidding, they were the most difficult weeks of my life that I have ever lived, but just all part of God's sense of humor, at the same time that they were the most difficult weeks of my life that I ever lived, I also finished the book. So God... I don't know, it takes, maybe it took major trauma to make it happen, I don't know. So, I have several copies of it printed up for review. I'm gonna have to edit it one more time, but I've basically got it written and I wanted several people to look at it and give me some feedback. So if any of you are interested in that, you should let me know. I have to work out it, to print it up. I've got 10 copies of them, and it cost a fair amount of money, so I have to kind of work out the finances of it. But if you're seriously interested in seeing a pre-publication, still to be edited one more time, version of the book to for my benefit, to give me some feedback on it, it's available. So, thanks.